of Communication Studies at the Universitat Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona. And he's going to talk, well, you can see what the title is, so useless of me to repeat what is written up there, but you can see what it is. So perhaps without more ado, without wasting more time, can I pass on to Christopher?
Thanks very much. Well, yeah, just to reiterate Jaume's apologies for not being able to be here this afternoon, but it is for quite serious health reasons, and unfortunately couldn't make the journey. But we were going to do this together anyway, and he was going to do more or less the first third of today's presentation. I would do the following two thirds, so I'm going to try and take on the whole presentation myself. There's been a lot of counter-programming this afternoon for this lecture, as it seems that Boris has decided to once again put everybody against the wall, and also Franco, as you know, has returned in a big way.
Been resuscitated.
And it did remind me of the opening moments of a legendary American TV show, which you may remember, called Saturday Night Live, at the end of the 70s, which was John Belushi and Bill Murray. And at the beginning of the show, there were two presenters. And as the credits came up, the opening line was, welcome to Saturday Night Live. And yes, Franco is still dead. And then they would open the show. And I was thinking of this Franco is still dead line today as we saw the helicopter taking Franco to be buried alongside his wife. And I'm not sure if you're aware, but the priest who is carrying out the ceremony is the son of Tejero. It's really an extraordinary moment. And if you come from Barcelona, it's been fun as well the last few weeks, to not say years, but the last few weeks particularly. So it's been a very interesting few days. But anyway, despite the rain, I'm really grateful for you turning up at 6 o'clock on this dark now Thursday evening in London. So thanks for coming. My idea is to project, to give you an idea of what we've been studying for 10 years now, in three different projects. Jaume was going to open today's lecture by saying, 10 years ago, I came to the LSE to read some newspapers, which is exactly what he did. But what he wasn't going to confess is that he told us he was coming to London for 3 months. On the 25th of August, I still remember because he called us in from the beach to tell us that he was coming, and then this is when it all started. So a full decade later, we've just closed the shop and brought the curtain down on 10 years of the national and international press coverage of the transition. Now, we have done this all the way through to 1982, to the socialist victory, but today we're talking basically about 75 to 78 because it's got many of the greatest hits of the translation. So if you don't mind, Sebastian, I was going to stand up.
No, please go ahead. Absolutely.
Once a lecturer, always a lecturer. So this is just a quick run through, just so you can get an idea of the three projects that we've done. They're different amongst themselves. The first one was basically an analysis of the work of the foreign correspondents of 11 newspapers, which was great because we all got the chance to go to different countries, except for me. And I was stuck in the Archivo General de la Administración in Alcalá de Henares for weeks, which is the less glamorous part of the trip. But the second project was based on the Spanish press. So we looked at 13 Spanish newspapers. And then the final project, which we are finishing in 2 months' time, 31st of December, is on magazines, which are often the Cinderella media. Nobody tends to look at magazines, and really interesting. So I myself looked at Time, Newsweek and The Economist to see how they frame the transition, bearing in mind how important they are as policy-making publications. So adding them all up, we looked at 36 different publications, 20 moments in the Spanish transition, and there are 6 universities in our team, and Jaume was a team leader. This is how we did it. We interviewed a lot of foreign correspondents. You have to bear in mind that in order to be a foreign correspondent in 1975 in Spain, That means that everybody's round about 75 years old if you were a young correspondent. So many of our correspondents have since deceased. And our youngest foreign correspondents are 75 years old. So it was quite interesting tracking them down. We managed to do that with Spanish reporters as well. Then we called in foreign correspondents and called in Spanish reporters to see if their stories played out, what they remember, that's how the Spanish reporters remembered them. And then we did the same thing with journalists who covered the transition in Spain and with Spanish politicians to see how they played off each other. We went to all these archives, and like I say, I was in Alcalá. So this is the part that Jaume was going to present to you, which was the research question, which was basically the role of the press in general during the Spanish transition. And we wanted to bring in two elements. One is the role of the foreign press, and the second was to challenge the idea of the Spanish press as a decisive institution in what's now been called, obviously, the Parlamento de Papel, or the paper parliament. So does that really pan out or not? This is the balance of the three projects together, you know, just as a flash shot. What we can see is, in general, pragmatic support from the newspapers, playing sometimes both cards. We'll see in a moment, but for example, the American press was 100% behind Arielta and Amfraga. And then, okay, now Suarez, because where did he come from? But you'll see this jumping ship, that's why the conference is called the Odd U-Turn. Extremely critical of the king, Juan Carlos, and then turns around. Whereas the Spanish press, obviously, is under still the 1966 press law, so there was unconditional support for the movements that were made. But their working conditions were very different as well. And as for the magazines, well, that's interesting because I think this is full. Yep. This is full coming. And so for the magazines, it's a different ballgame, highly critical on both sides. So, just to do a bit of promotion. This is what we've been.
Sorry, can I just I apologise.
No worries.
It's the joint fault of Boris Johnson and General Franco.
I can't compete. I can't compete. I'm doing my best. So this is what we've published more or less every couple of years. You know, books coming out, and for those of you who are interested, we're doing a special issue. The IGIS magazine on this subject, which will be in the spring of next year. Publishing here. Okay, so off we go. Like I said, these are the slides that Jaume was going to present. So, in general terms, the influence of the foreign press, you can see here that what the foreign correspondents were producing and what the editorials were saying were very, very close together. Not very much of a divorce between the two of them. Obviously, criticism of Arias, which we'll see in a moment. Initial distrust of the tandem, the dream team of Juan Carlos and Adolfo Suarez. Their support for the two of them comes later on. It's not immediate. Huge role that Le Monde plays, which we'll come to in a moment. And the Anglo-American press was key, not only for governmental, but also for opposition messages, particularly through the magazines. So, as regards the Spanish press, which was the second project, this is just a quick photograph. The Francoist press was obviously restricting the Spanish journalists considerably. And we still have these prohibitions right up until the Constitution, which of course is criticism of the monarchy, criticism of the army, and attacks on the unity of Spain, which sounds like 2019. So not much change there. The editors of the newspapers at the time were obviously backdating to the Francoist period, except, for example, for Diario 16 in Madrid, and Avui in Barcelona, and Deia Negui in Basque Country.
So we do have exceptions amongst the magazines, which is Cuadernos, which is of course from Franco's period, and Triunfo. We're also at a time when of course magazines like Interview have come along, which are offering a huge counterweight to the newspaper. Remember that Interview in its greatest moment is reaching up to 1 million copies. It's really extraordinary statistics. As regards the unequal nature of the so-called Parlamento de Papel, well, we can see here that the newspapers were favourable towards the government and the candidates of Suárez and Fraga, right? No surprise here, whether it's La Vanguardia, which of course will be playing this kind of moderate role, or El País, which obviously is in favour of democratic options, whereas the magazines are more critical towards the government and quite clearly more on the democratic opposition side. There are exceptions like this, where magazines or publications directly link themselves to political options. So this is where I was going to come in. And so what we decided to do was to look at six moments. It was originally five. We'll be throwing number four, as John asked me to take a look at. So these are like the greatest hits from the death of Franco up to the first elections. And so there are six snapshots, but for a conference like today, it's good enough to give us a kind of a decent sample of what's going on. So there we are. 24th of October 2019 has just been moved. Probably doesn't look like that now, but the Francoist legacy. So we can see not only on the pages of Arriba and the Catholic daily Ya, but also of course on La Vanguardia, which we have to remember is La Vanguardia Española. Vanguardia Española. Vivo en la Historia, it's a very prophetic headline. And what we can basically see, and it's not surprising, is that for the first few days after the 20th of November, there's a general atmosphere and editorial positioning of respect for what was the Francoist legacy, right? Where we are, November the 75. So there's a kind of uniform positive reading. I chose some phrases here. Yas' phrase is quite good because it leaves you a little bit out. It says, his legacy is so huge that any superlative would only reduce it, which kind of limits your capacity to enter into any kind of debate. And what's interesting about Ya, of course, and this is a newspaper that I particularly had studied, and we did like a book together, and I had to do the Ya chapter. Considering Franco directly responsible for the popularity of the new monarch, which is interesting, this kind of transference of popularity of King Juan Carlos was also Franco's testimony. Maybe no surprises here. The difference between Ya and ABC is that ABC keeps going. If you look at the newspapers of February, March, April, 76, it's as if Franco died yesterday and not 6 months ago. So this is, and Carmen Polo here, this legacy is longer in ABC's pages. This is kind of interesting, because no surprises so far. La Vanguardia Española, of course, remember, is owned by Godó, right? And he declares himself in a very rare full-page article signed by Godó. He doesn't do this very much. Declared himself to be proud to have formed part of the Spain he forged. So, uniform respect for Franco's legacy. Now, when we move to the magazines, they cover the death of Franco, but immediately take an extra step forward. Okay, he's dead. What's coming? And you can see this in Cuadernos, in Triunfo, en Cambio 16. Whilst the Gazette, La Actualidad Española, a little bit more benevolent. But the magazines, I mean, this is a really interesting front cover. La Muerte. There's actually, you know, Franco doesn't actually appear on this. And I think that itself is quite a statement, black and white, front cover. So let's move to the international press, which of course was the original project. And of course here the temperature turns up. La Stampa refers to Francoism as that. The German press is the same. The New York Times editorial speaks of a man who, when in doubt, repressed. It was an interesting foreworder. And the editorial talks about someone who was hated by many, loved by few. So there's a huge difference between the national and the international press and their reception of Franco's death. Now, The Economist here, right, moving into magazines, they, of course, are once a week, so they've got slightly more time to react. We get longer pieces, much more text, which is why they deserve much more treatment than they've ever got. Magazines are completely overlooked in press, transitional historiography. And we get longer pieces. After Franco, Hope and Fear, that kind of Economist dry headline, two big words that need deciphering for readers. And with Franco and Juan Carlos in a kind of pensive mode here in an Economist. So then we move on from Franco, and of course Juan Carlos starts to take over, and is unanimously criticised by the international press. I mean, really slammed. This has been a mistake. He doesn't know what he's doing. Across the board criticism in the first few months. I mean, they don't give him very much time either. I mean, he's asked not to lose credibility in 3 days from the death of Franco. It's not much of a margin. It's not giving you much breathing space. The New York Times walks up, be careful here. We could be talking about continuation of Francoism without Franco. And they're really slightly over the top. Not giving, you know, we talk about, especially in an American context, about 100 days of grace. Well, Juan Carlos wasn't given 100 days of grace. He was given a week, basically. Stampa, once again, furious about the King's Christmas message, which is only a month later. And this one, you know, quite a nasty little phrase. Not putting his weight behind change. This is The Economist. It's a bad beginning. And Juan Carlos is dithering. He's dithering, he's unable or unwilling. It's not the same. It's not the same. To control Spain's rearguard. Right. He's got off to a bad start. He's acting weakly. So, yeah, he's unsuccessful. Well, this is where he is, yeah. But of course, when the King goes to the United States in June 76, then there's like a huge overhaul in terms of his international press protection. And of course, remember, it's the bicentennial of the United States. Of course, the King speaks before Congress, and the NYT decides that, okay, he is the King for Democracy, and the Italian press is now calling the Artifice of Change, and the Times says that we can now put an end to these jokes about Juan Carlos the Brief. So, 6 months later, Juan Carlos is now starting to get better press, but particularly after his trip to the United States. In Spain, we can see, you know, being considered a symbol of reconciliation. Time magazine calls him a new king with clout. I mean, it's a 360-degree turnaround. Cambio 16, ganó el rey, no? Contra viento y marea. So, the king is now gaining momentum. Our third stop is this change in the early summer of 76, where we can see that the press, particularly the international press, is absolutely in favour of Arias' resignation, but doesn't see Suarez coming, and doesn't see Suarez, once he's arrived, to be the man. And they gave, the international press gave Ariel Fraga lots of space. This is a full page. This is with Newsweek. This is Miguel Acoca. Miguel Acoca is a Panamanian journalist whose works for Newsweek. You may know that Newsweek had two correspondents in Spain. It's quite interesting. Acoca is from Panama. One of the other correspondents was Tom Burns, who's the grandson of
Gregorio Marañón.
And so Burns is a young journalist. I mean, he's 25, 30 years old here. He's working with Acoca, pumping out information for Newsweek. And so there's a unanimous no to Suarez. The French called him a Francoist heir. This show, once again, Financial Times, piling in on the king. The Guardian, Suarez could be worse than Arias. I mean, they're terrible things, our archives. German press says Spain is still a regime, and that Suarez is a fascist in position. It's a literal translation from Italian. Whereas in Spain, of course, it's one of the moments where you see there's absolute coincidence with the international press. We've got the legendary article by Theodore Aquí. I love this one. El Alcázar, it's one of our own. How sad is that for Suarez? And La Vanguardia, you know, that kind of, it's possible that it's a good change, it's probable that it isn't. Classic, I mean, somebody who spent 30 years in Barcelona, you know, the classic Catalan headline, you know, like, yeah, I've said it, but I haven't quite said it. It's possible, you have to read it three times to get one. It's better, of course, in Spanish, but and quite a lot of Fraga, you know, real options, you know, it's La Carrera Presidencia. So Suarez really was was a surprise, and before it even started, he was getting hammered in the same way as Juan Carlos. The difference is that Suarez gets the press, international press, particularly on his side, very quickly. With his style, and suddenly by the end of 76, before 76, we can see Suarez being received in this manner, Time calling him a unique political phenomenon, a miracle worker, says Newsweek, an attractive candidate who they know and have learned to trust, and so on. So Suarez, in the space of like 4 or 5 months, really gets the press on. So a fourth point to look at is, of course, you know, territorial issues, and this is not part of today's conference necessarily, but this is interesting because we've got a whole domino game going on in Mediterranean Europe here, right? What happened in Greece, of course, what happened in Portugal, with Italy, and you know, the access of, so the access that we've had to the cables of Kissinger. Saying, you know, let's keep this in control. Of course, we've got the military bases in Rota, etc. And so territorial tensions were really present in Time, Newsweek, at this time. I mean, you can see this is the front cover of Time, Europe's angry minorities. Right? Not really quite sure that Wales and Euskadi is parallel, but anyway, but remember, we're talking, you know, mainstream magazines. These are not the political, you know, political science journals for the Council on Foreign Relations. These are airport magazines. So we've got to explain this to our readers. Militant minorities here, like Alsace-Lorraine, for example, Corsica, Brittany, yeah, all kicking off, because this is the late 70s. I remember there was that burning of English, if I'm not wrong, you know, the burning of English tourists' second homes in Wales. I may remember that towards the end of the 70s. And so the magazines click onto this and are extremely worried about what's going on, and it's in the press all the time. So this is Time Reporter Nielsen, and I've chosen some phrases, especially like for today, because some of them could have been said 2 weeks ago. And if you were, I haven't had time to do this, but if you were to compare some of the Foreign Correspondents' Chronicles from 15 days ago and to what was being said in 1977, some extraordinary parallels. Obviously not so much in the case of the Basque Country now, but certainly with regard to Catalonia. And so we start to get this sort of like anthropological analysis of what Basques are, who Basques are, and Catalans are like, if they're really going to cause trouble and upset the apple cart, just when we're behind Suarez and the Spanish democratic experiment's really consolidating itself, and these are going to come along and spoil it. The royal family goes to Barcelona in February 76, and the Time correspondent says, Barcelona's on the brink of war. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to say, and slightly, you know, over the top, but tension is there. I mean, this is 3 months after the death of Franco. Right? We have to bear in mind that the great majority of foreign correspondents, particularly from the United States, who came to Spain for Franco's funeral, right, this is 1975, so came for the funeral, many of them had come directly from armed conflict. So, Vietnam has just finished, September 75, and in previous work, I don't know, if you look at the, if you do like a radiography of foreign correspondents who came to Spain, 429 came to Franco's funeral, 500 were here today. Mm. So it's the same, they're all here, but they were coming from the Lebanon, they were coming from Northern Ireland, and many of them were coming from Vietnam. Some of them came with helmets. You know, Martha Gellhorn came. Martha Gellhorn came and was like disappointed. And there's a legendary comment where she said, "You know, well, there's no action. What's you know?" And so they took her to Carabanchel so she could go and see some prisons and, you know, have something to write about. And extraordinary moment. So, you know, 90 days after, Barcelona's on the brink of war. And you start to get this sort of analysis by The Economist about Spain having historically failed Catalonia. Like this word muff, difficult to translate in Spanish. So the king had muffed the opportunity to give back status and so on. So there's criticism here about the position of Spain regarding Catalonia. But what's extraordinary, what was a real surprise to me, was the detail with which these magazines follow these kinds of dissident stories, if you like. The Times has an article on Montserrat, which I flew over this morning, and talks of it being a sign of discreet opposition. And they follow the Poblet story in an article which is called Shoot to Kill. The article is called Shoot to Kill in The Economist, referring to civil guards' decision to hunt Catalans and open fire, and here we go, on demonstrations of the pro-freedom march known as La Marcha de Libertad, which of course is what we had last Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, Las Marchas de la Libertad. So this detailed following of, you know, Montserrat, Poblet, I mean, this is Time, The Economist, we're not talking about Avui. Sam Boy, we get the Civil War reference again, and you know, The Economist couldn't resist this one. The dragon that St. George is being urged to slay is the centralism of Madrid, etc. So, 40 years ago, it's a metaphor still being thrown. Any time Madrid is expected to announce that it's granted Catalonia provisional home rule, according to The Economist. So, it's all over the place. It really is prevalent. The same thing applies, of course, for ETA. But here it's slightly more complicated, much more complicated, obviously because of the terrorism story, and also the difficulty of decodifying for a mainstream American public what's going on. And so Time and Newsweek do a kind of masters in ETA for its readers. And it's quite interesting, and they are referred to in different ways. I call this a didactic job. And they're referred to in different ways. These are all the labels that are used in the same article. At one point they're called a gang, and at one point they're actually called a Spanish group, which is the greatest irony of all. These are foreign correspondents here getting ready for an ETA press conference. And of course, most of them, the foreign correspondents, are going up to Biarritz, and they're at golf clubs, talking to members of ETA, and it's all very thrilling for them as press correspondents. And so this allows them to go into historical context and with a kind of Stockholm syndrome, buying some of the language that's being used by the interviewees, and so on. And so we start to get things like this. You know, Suarez should take charge to avoid another incident, and so on. Okay, last but one point. If Catalonia and Basque Country and so on was not enough for particularly the American press, the legalization of the Communist Party was, of course, a major issue. I love this headline. Spain's Red Luther. I thought you might like that one. No, it's a horror, but it's Spain's Red Luther. And Kissinger's domino theory is all over the place. It's all over Newsweek and Time. Carrillo is in Newsweek all the time, late 75, early 76. In clandestinity, and then when he comes out. And he's always being accused of agent provocateur, he's always provoking the bunker. Always. And this is the problem. It's not so much the PC in itself, it's that they might provoke great attention and the right will come back and we're off again. That's the focus. And then there's a moment in spring 77, when Eurocommunism is embraced by particularly the American weeklies, and is accepted as being like the lesser evil. And the press welcomes Carrillo because he's breaking away from Soviet communism. And so suddenly you can see the focus just changing. It's a very interesting moment on the pages of the international process. It's with about 6 weeks. They're all behind the legalization of the party. But once again, both the French press and the Italian press follow the military displeasure at the legalization, keeping tabs on this. Some people are not happy. Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung is just absolutely crucial to Suarez's future projection. NYT fall of the last barricade, and the Telegraph calls it the most decisive proof of break of Francoism. So there's a certain coherence in the press here. But in the national press, in the Spanish press, it's a question of stability and internal order. Almost all the dailies advocate legalization. You can imagine the ones that don't. It's not that difficult, right? Cafe, etc. No, obviously, it's not their story. But then the more interesting ones, it's easy to look at El País and easy to look at Alcázar. It's much more complex to look at newspapers like Ya and ABC. What was their position? And there's this idea of no to communism, yes to the legalization of Partido Comunista. This is Ya. No to communism, yes to the legalization of the PP. They do not trust Carrillo, it's all over the press. But what can we do? Yeah, we have to go. ¿Qué se puede hacer con los comunistas? How Spanish is that? It was intentado, eh? two exceptions here about the PCE story. This is ABC. Not happy, and is then considered a grave decision. Right? And what happens is that ABC does not sign the comment editorial, which is signed by all the Madrid dailies. They do a joint editorial, and ABC does not sign it. So there's this like inertia, and then ABC kind of pulls back. And
Alcázar, obviously,
radical opposition to legalisation. Oops, sorry. Yeah. And then, of course, we have the elections, and I call this Suarez superstar, right? The Times calls the 15th of June the end of the beginning. Le Monde reminds his readers that Suarez comes from television, screen politics, 3 years away from Reagan. And La Stampa is absolutely pro-Suarez. He's intelligent, practical, and acts as if he has no ideology at all. An interesting phrase. And so he's, they are, you can't, it's good metaphors, killing the Francoist bulls. This is basically a summary of what the international press particularly considers Suarez to be good at. And that's the result. It's an obsession with dissent. And this is actually directly taken from the Kissinger cables. We have to support the center. And what is interesting is that the Newsweek, of all those possible options for a headline, takes the center holds. Suarez superstar in red and blue. But beyond the magazines, you can see it's widespread. The German press considers the result to be the end of the Civil War. And The Guardian talks about the end of the bunker. The national press may be more interesting, because Suarez is very persuasive and so on. This is Por Favor, right, magazines. I love this. This is Fraga and Suarez. I'm not sure if you can see at the back. Último rollo, ¿qué les vamos a contar? That's Franco's taking his children to school. ABC, not quite sure what was going to happen, hedged its bets, and so both. La Guardia pro Suarez. Ya was a direct benefactor because many of the leading writers of Ya became members of Suarez's first cabinet. ABC said, okay, fair enough. There's a generational change. But the satirical magazines hold out, and then they don't give themselves over to Suarez that easily. And they're sort of like unconvinced by this hype around the democratic discourse of, the poster boy of the transition that Suarez is in 1977. So, drawing to an end now, and not to go on too long. These are the kind of conclusions that we've brought together from the three projects that I mentioned earlier. Regarding Franco, we can see an open divergence, which is probably not that surprising given the conditions which we're under in November 1975. Local journalists are constrained by press law. Self-censorship was the order of the day. Remember that at this moment, even in 75, 76, 77, and the first few months of 78, newspapers will have to be given over for pre-reading, and then they'll give a stamp of approval for them to be distributed, 10 p.m. in the evening. And in Alcalá de Henares. You can still access the archives there of those newspapers who just started not to hand over their tomorrow's front page to see if they were going to get fined or not, and they were fined. So how long would you try and hold out? So conditions were, you know, were tough. But of course, the foreign press is completely negative about Franco's legacy, and it's this very kind of like post World War II frame that's used around Franco. The 50s and the 60s are pretty well overlooked. It's all about 30s and 40s in the press. There's consensus about the doubts regarding the young king on both sides, which is quite interesting because that means the international correspondents and the local journalists were equally as dubious. There's consensus regarding Arias Navarro. There's a interview in January 1976 with Arias Navarro, and you can see right from the beginning that he has absolutely no intention of carrying out a reform plan. It's like digs his own grave, which then leads to the April interview of 76, when, of course, the king privately confides that Arias Navarro is an unmitigated disaster. No? Disaster sin paliativos. And that wasn't published. And then the royal household said, well, it was supposed to be off the record. And there's almost a slightly diplomatic incident here. Considered to have breached the trust and so on. But that phrase, disastrous in paliativos, was just the end of Arias Navarro. But what's interesting, it was a foreign press interview. There's consensus regarding Suarez's nomination. It's a disaster. It's good, you know, this is somebody coming from the Movimiento. It's a wrong move. And there's consensus in the international press and the national press about their interest in backing other candidates. Ayotes is all over the place. Fraga coming back from London. But then we have consensus regarding Suarez once he's in. Everybody changes. That's why about the U-turn in the title of the conference. And everybody gets on board in the decision to push this stability agenda. You know, we've got things like Aldo Moro in Italy. And buying a mine pop. It's serious. And, you know, chips in for Spain to make sure they don't get contaminated by this Mediterranean, Italy, Greece, but Germany, this European environment, you know, extreme political tension. When we talk about national press, we can't group it together that quickly because, of course, we've got to divide between the pre-Francoist titles, La Vanguardia, etc., and the Democratic era newspapers. So throughout the studies, we've always had to have these two things in mind. Yeah. Unequal working conditions between the foreign correspondents and local journalists. It's not just a question of press laws and censorship. It's a question that foreign correspondents had an unbelievable advantage. You know, the Spanish politicians at the time were often resorted to them to get their messages across and gave, you know, exclusives and scoops, long interviews. There is one in inside of the Newsweek or Time, which is they spent 3 days with the king just before Suarez's election. And everything is referred to in the third person. It's not a direct interview, but the third person discourse. So you can see a papus here, and this is supposed to be the Spanish press. Right? So he's writing the article with his feet. International press were exploited their wider margin for manoeuvre. All this thing about if you really want to know in 76, 77, if you still want to know what's going on, read Le Monde, right, which is a classic expression. They were lucky because they got direct access to all sources, you know, whether it's ETA, whether it's Catalan politicians, whether it's big shots in the cabinet. They're free from restrictions. They were used as a channel by local journalists as well, which are local journalists who knew that they couldn't get their stories out. So they filtered them to foreign correspondents who then published them, particularly in pro-democratic local journalists. In 76, when El País is just about to be born, ideas were passed on and they could get around local restrictions. And of course, the surveillance measures, it's absolutely no comparison. So it is true that the international press did have a certain advantage. And it's 7:05, so I thought maybe this would be a moment to stop. So once again, thanks for coming, and if anybody's got a question, I'd be delighted to try and answer, or at least get involved in some debate with you. So thanks very much.
I don't know if you want to lead with the first question, Paul. But first of all, I'd like to thank Dr. Tallack on behalf of everybody here for an absolutely fascinating presentation. Actually, very, very interesting about the relationship between the position, you know, the international press and the patterns that lay behind, the political patterns that lay behind their interpretation of that. I mean, yeah. In particular, when you're referring to the stability agenda.
Yeah.
I didn't see that reflection of those patterns in the earlier part of your talk, but maybe we can come back to it later. For instance, 1975 and 1976. Mm-hmm. That you gave a fairly descriptive account of how papers were reacting, but what was the agenda that lay behind?
I mean, there's the key moment in this is for me is the trip to Washington, the trip to the United States, where Kissinger really prepares the American administration for the visit of the king, and said, okay, the king is coming, and it's been a rocky road so far, and we need to send out the message to the ambassador in Spain that we're behind stability. And there's a phrase which I'm going to misquote, but it's something about Spain, as he says, like Spain has traditionally wavered between anarchy and disorder or something, and what we need to do is we need to sponsor the center, which makes those headlines, those front pages, interesting, because I put two on here to show different ones. Mm. But there is another front page that also uses the word center. The center holds, the center wins. It's almost like direct paraphrasing. And we can see this worry about the domino effect of terrorist organisations in Germany, Italy, and of course in Ireland. And there's just genuine concern about stability. There is, of course, the military, American military presence in Spain. An interesting example of that is that, if you remember, in the 27th of September 75, when Franco executes the Basque prisoners, there is international outrage in the press. But in the United States, it's quite mild. And our journey begins when Franco dies. But if you look at October 75, when Franco is ill now, mm-hmm. and it's the end, the newspapers and the American magazines print what is basically an apology for their mild attitude towards condemning these executions. And it's explained in geopolitical terms. Mm-hmm. And there is a map of the military, there's a map of Rota. Look, my readers, you have to understand that, okay, we don't agree with the executions, but the risk here is this domino effect. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to upset Spain. And that's why they seem to have had almost a direct influence in the mild, comparatively mild attitude towards condemning the executions. So That's October 75. So the stability agenda is prior to to Franco's death. And of course, a year prior to that, in October 74, Franco falls ill again, well, for the first time. And that's when the journalists start to arrive. In October 74, which is 6 months after Portugal. So the pieces are sort of set in place and the work begins. But of course, Franco recovers. And so many journalists go home and then find themselves obliged to come a year later. And the presence of foreign press correspondents through until the end of 1978 is really remarkable. I mean, there's 150 accredited foreign correspondents covering right through until 1978. When the Constitution comes along, that's the end of the story. And that's why it's less interesting to go from 79 to 82, with one big exception, of course, which is, of course, 23F, right? But that's not a correspondent story. That's a special envoy story.
Right.
That's not the same people who've been pumping out stories every day to people who fly over to cover the story in 15 days. So, yeah, I'd say from about October 74, when Franco falls ill, until the Constitution, there's 4 years of extraordinary production rates about Spain, and you can see that it's a question of informing the public. I had some data as well about Time and Newsweek readers. 83% of all congressmen and women are reading these two magazines. 70% of businessmen. 85% of mass media executives. So these are like the policy makers' publications. And it was just a golden age of sales for them as well. So their magazines were selling like hotcakes. Foreign correspondents were here. It was just the Spain, you know, in a non-academic way, suddenly became sexy.
Thank you very much for that. I'm sure other people, including Paul, have questions to ask.
For me, this was like sort of someone recalling a holiday we were all on together. I mean, not that it was a holiday, but, you know, every one of those, well, not everyone, but damn near everything that he showed, I had clippings from. I don't know what I ever did with them. But obviously went through all of that. And it's interesting, I mean, this is reminiscent, not really a question, but to support what you just said, inevitably I knew a lot of the correspondents.
Yep.
Walter Howard.
Mm-hmm.
I never, oddly enough, I never ever met Marcel Nidigo,
mm-hmm.
but who, I'm not sure if he ever came to Spain. Who was the other guy in the who wrote for Le Monde, who actually signed the, Nidigo.
Yes, yeah.
The other guy, Jose, the one who wrote the amazing.
Novais. Jose,
yeah.
Antonio Novais.
Yeah. But anyway,
he wrote a lot of stuff.
I was sort of finishing my PhD, and I was getting commissioned to do, like today, you know, lots of radio interviews, lots of articles, New Statesman, The Nation in New York, and I was thinking, this is great, you know, I'm on the way here, you know. And of course, what you just said about how this only worked for 4 years, for those 4 years, and then the procession moved on,
yeah,
you know, and so my great career in journalism fell off the cliff. But I have a very allusively specific question, which won't interest anyone else. When did Arriba stop publishing?
Arriba?
Great newspaper.
Yeah.
Because obviously you're gonna slip up.
Yeah,
it's
still going.
And
yep.
I don't know whether it went.
I'm going to slip up there.
The Movimiento was...
Because as a research team, we, you know, we divided, there's like 13 of us, and so we all took different things. And I basically took charge of the Anglo-American weeklies. But my colleague had Alcázar, and he had a great time, you know, doing Alcázar. And I think one of our colleagues in Salamanca had Arriba. And... But yeah, it keeps going. I would guess 77, 78, but I'm not sure.
I can't remember now when the last, I'm not sure.
But you were talking about Walter Holbrook, like really interesting about the Stockholm Syndrome and how close they were to the story, is that the Junta Democrática is like declared in his house. Now this is a journalist who offers his house for, you know, for the founding of what was going to be La Junta Democrática.
What it's worth.
Go on.
I found the protagonist.
Go on.
I was the interpreter of Junta, the English interpreter of Junta Democrática, which is how I came to know Carrillo. And of course, we can believe me, led on to go past by Carrillo.
Yeah.
Another story.
Chislett. Who's still alive?
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
William. He was just in Madrid. He was 24.
Yeah. And he does a fantastic protagonism really well.
And I interviewed him a couple of times for this.
And well, he wrote a little booklet.
Yes.
About the press and the transition.
Yeah. And he now works for El Cano. The El Cano Institute. But Gisela's a good example because he was just here. English and, you know, translating, and then he realised that he had the opportunity to jump in, and 24, 25 years old, became the Times correspondent in Madrid covering Franco's death and Suarez and ETA, and, you know, like 25 years old, the Times. I mean, it's not.
There was a lot of. Chislett was having to be in.
That's right, yeah. He was the dean of the correspondence.
Yeah, and was quite old.
Yes.
And the Guardian American correspondent was, off his head alcoholic. I can't remember his name now. And that. What the hell? Sorry. This is bringing back so many wonderful
memories.
I'm sure there are questions from other people as well.
Please go ahead, yeah.
The Guardian's correspondent was called Bill Tremon Jones.
Absolutely, yes.
Known in the office as Crumbling Bones. And I have just come back.
My
name is Richard Gott.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm also a Guardian correspondent, but I spent a lot of time in Latin America. But I came back to London that year, it was 1975.
That's right.
And I was sent off to Madrid on the instructions of the travel editor, who said, we're very worried in the travel business that Spain is going to go the way of Portugal.
There you are.
So could you go over to Madrid or Barcelona and discover what is the truth behind all these rumours that Spain is very unstable and anything might happen? So I went over and spent a few weeks wandering around. And I thought, I'd never seen a country that is less ready for revolution.
You just come back from Cuba.
Yes. And so I read this in the Guardian, two or three articles, saying, you know, Spain is not going to go the way of Portugal. They're very far from it. They're, you know, going to have a very smooth transition.
Was it Semlin Jones?
Hemlin Jones,
yeah. Because Tremlett was Giles Tremlett as well.
Yeah. Giles was much later.
Just interesting anecdote, these things come up. When we're tracking down correspondence and to find out, you know, sometimes we didn't get any answers back. But we managed to pick up the Le Monde correspondent, who's one of the few female correspondents, called Anne-Marie Romero. And it's an extraordinary story, because we divided up. And so someone went to Italy, someone went to France, someone went to New York, I went to Alcalá de Henares. But the girl who went to, a colleague at the university who went to Paris, went to the Arc and started reading Le Monde, 75 to 1978, and saw Anne-Marie Romero, and then found out that she was still alive, and somehow got her phone number. And rang her and said, look, I'm from the university here in Barcelona. I'm researching what you wrote in 75, 76, 77. Do you think we could meet for an interview? And she said, yes, no problem. And so roots out, tell me where you live and I'll go. And she described where she lived. They lived on the same road. And she said, well, what number do you live in? I'm inventing. 89. They were in the same building. And she went, I'm on the third floor. She said, I'm on the fourth. And she went up with a cup of coffee, knocked on her door and said, hello, can you believe that? That only happens in a Tom Hanks movie. That doesn't happen in real life. Unbelievable. So she literally put the phone down, put the coffee machine on, and went upstairs. It's an extraordinary story. And of course, was with Anne-Marie for like a month and a half, having dinner and having coffee, and got the full story about Le Monde, which is a really interesting case, you know. So shared frontiers and so on. But Richard, I think you're out there in our study, because of course we pick up names that fly in and fly out. There's somebody who we were after for a long time, you might be able to help me with, which was somebody called Robert McLaughlin. And we were after this guy he was a guardian in Barcelona. And we know he's alive, but we can't find him. And so, and then we had one, the other female journalist, a British journalist, who died a week before I was going to interview her. And I spoke to her husband, and she said, I'm sorry, she's just died.
Are there any other questions? It doesn't have to come from people who witnessed the process, by the way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Fisherman's tales.
Did you do any other press stories?
Yeah. I was going to say, will you show us what the press has said about the American view of the transition and so forth? Do you think that the US administration itself had a lot of importance in what the king did?
That's more a question maybe for this man than for me. But what I can say is that journalism history is also plagued with, you know, fishermen's tales and so on about its exaggerated consideration of its own importance. But what we did found out is that, for example, the Time, Newsweek, Economist, and the FT were taken to all the Council on Foreign Relations meetings in Washington. You know, they're on the table, working document. This is what people over there are saying. Which is quite interesting, because they're obviously combining, for example, diplomatic cables, but with what foreign correspondents were saying of the respected weeklies. Because these have got a huge advantage over the daily press, which is, of course, their production cycles. So if you're writing an article about Atocha, you may have a week to write that, which means that you've got the chance of more sources coming in, so the quality of the material is better. And these things were elevated, which it says particularly with the 23rd of February 1981, which is the case study that I presented 2 weeks ago in Santiago de Compostela, because there's something that doesn't make sense, is that in the United States, 23F is not a story until the 7th of March. What? It's 14 days. And it's on the front cover, but it's on the front cover 2 weeks later. So what happened? And it turns out that on the 24th of February, which is something that Tejero hadn't thought about, Charles announced his engagement to Princess Diana. And it's all up. There's nothing else in the American press. And so we often say that, you know, international correspondency works as, and its relationship with the foreign desk is like a one-ball juggler. We don't keep three balls in the air at the same time. We do one. Yeah. And so it's Charles and Diana, Charles and Diana. So, of course, when you've only got one shot in the week, which takes you to the 1st of March, you're then on the 7th of March. Enormous advantage for the Newsweek Time correspondents, because they've got 14 days to go back. Because, you know, between the 23rd of February and the 7th of March, it's like, you know, years go by. And so the quality of their stories is really like 6-7 page specials, you know, tight text with 4 or 5 columns. So these things are, sorry, it's a long-winded answer. These things are going to the Council of Foreign Relations, and that is certainly reaching, it's filtering through. I can take it that far, but not further. It's like halfway.
Yes.
Could you say anything about the regional press in Spain? Because you're concentrating on ABC and,
yeah,
and ICE, of course.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a number of the newspaper reading public are actually, you know, if you look at Basque Country,
yep,
they're not reading either of those publications, mm-hmm, they're not reading Deia either.
Yep.
And you know, those papers are a lot more serious than a British mid-market paper, shall we say.
Yes, for like the El Correo, no, for example.
El Correo,
yeah,
or Norte de Castilla. Or
they were left out of the study, to be perfectly honest. I think I gave you the stat that we looked at like 13 papers, I think, and they were left out of the study. There was an interest in, if you like, the slightly more spectacular end of the Basque newspaper market, which would have been Deia Egin, or when you come to Catalonia, Avui is in there. And they're also, you know, 1976 newspapers, Avui. El Correo's not in there. El Heraldo de Aragon, for example, which is a good example. These papers were left out. I mean, there was a limit. And I'm sure there's material there. I'm sure there's material there for sure. Because many of them had great young reporters as well who then went on to better, you know, more spectacular things. But yeah, of course their readership is not as, I mean, the example of Correo is a bit, is the best one, but if you were to extend it to other autonomous communities, it don't give you the material that maybe the ones, you know, national newspapers give you. You know, La Voz de Galicia been a good example. No, we didn't get that far. It was just I mean, yeah, it's just a question of resources. But there is material there, undoubtedly. And I, one thing I'm working on now is here, it's not on paper, is I sometimes get the feeling that when we look at the New York Times and El País, it's like going to the delicatessen, whereas sometimes it's easier or more interesting just to go to Tesco's. And Tesco's is the agencies. But that's really hard work. So, you know, what would be really interesting, and what I'm trying to persuade colleagues now, is for one final project, which is AP, Reuters, PA, maybe even IFE, because that's where 80% of the material is. But that's hard work. So I've now got the AP archive specialist on board, and I've asked her for some samples. And the thing is that the samples she sent me are absolutely fascinating. I'd rather she'd sent me samples that sort of thought, oh, move on. But she sent me like trailers, it's like, you know, teasers, which is what the Reuters, the AP correspondent, wrote and what appeared in American newspapers. In other words, what the papers took from the cable. This is the full cable, and this is what appeared. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a lot of work, but it's interesting. Really interesting stuff.
There was another question. Yes, over there.
Yes. Hi. When I visited Spain 2013, one point I'm very interested in, the relation between Franco and monarchy, gave me a feeling that without his support, the new king shouldn't have returned power. Yes, how about now the monarchy? What their attitude toward the Franco?
What's the attitude of...
Well, yeah, yeah, and now the king and the queen and the lead in the monarchy, and Spanish monarchy, what's their attitude toward the Franco?
What's the Spanish monarchy's attitude towards
that
Franco?
How do they find that? What do you think of?
That's it. We can turn the recorder off now.
By the way, I'm from China, professor from Central Policy School. I work for the Communist Party.
Uh-huh.
And I'm now a research fellow here. You might feel a little bit
No. It's an interesting question, but I honestly don't think I'm authorised to answer that question. I don't.
It is dead because it's the official visit. They interviewed their history and told us that, like, that when Franco was in power,
yeah,
he tried his best to. Yes, it's kind of. Yes, when he's in power, nobody can say anything. But after him, he tried his best. He thinks that the democracy should be returned. At least give me a feeling of that. I'm not sure if that's the case.
I think Paul's choking at the air.
Well, in my view, I mean, you've just raised another issue. In my view, for what it's worth, there is no way in a million years that Franco wanted to see the return of democracy. Consistently, I mean, not only did he set up, well, through what was obviously a legal system and an institutional system that was arranged to ensure there would be no return to democracy, and he died convinced that Juan Carlos would be closely guarded, invigilated, etc. Regarding your question, what was his attitude to the monarchy? Okay. Well, as a young man, he was a monarchist and was made a gentleman of the chamber by Alfonso XIII. But he betrayed the monarchy in 1931. I mean, Franco was only ever interested in Franco. You know, Franco was the greatest Francoist. Now, when it came to, I mean, in the Civil War, to get the whole process of getting to be Caudillo and Generalissimo and Jefe del Estado and all of that, he obviously, I mean, he told all the different groups what they wanted to hear. He told the Falangists that he was a Falangista, he told the monarchists he was a monarchist, etc. And the key thing that he absolutely needed was the support of monarchist generals. But he consistently betrayed them by not restoring the monarchy. Now, theoretically, when things were getting quite tight in 1946-47, they came up, his acolytes came up with the Ley de Secesión, which is a mind-boggling piece of legislation that declares that Spain is a monarchy, but a monarchy without a king, and a monarchy that will be ruled over by a regent. Anyone in particular? Francisco Franco Bahamonde. And that he will continue to rule over as regent until such time he is prevented by incapacity or death from doing so. So, monarchists, I mean, some monarchists think, well, you know, it's a start. Others are livid and not pleased at all. And there's a monarchist opposition. And not an opposition that's prepared to die or go to much trouble. But nonetheless, there is an opposition. And they support the legitimate heir to the throne. And the key thing here, about if you're a monarchist, you have to believe in two things. The legitimacy of the monarchical line. And if you're a real freak, divine right. let's just stick with the legitimacy of the line. Now, the legitimate heir to the throne was Don Juan de Borbón, Juan Carlos' father. Franco wanted nothing to do with it. And again, for 30 years, Franco basically toyed with the various elements of the opposition. He had six candidates to be chosen as his eventual royal successor, which was a right he had given himself. It's a wonderful document in which Carrero Blanco, it's like something out of Shakespeare. He says, Your Excellency has the right to do this because Your Excellency is more than king. Your Excellency makes kings. Anyway, so he had six candidates, of whom, you know, the most obvious one should have been Don Juan de Borbón. But Don Juan de Borbón was suspected of being too democratic. When Franco chooses Juan Carlos in 1969, he is actually putting a bomb under the monarchy because he has broken the legitimacy of the line. Juan Carlos has no right to be king. His father should be, if you believe all that, right? Don Juan de Borbón should have been the royal successor. So what Franco has done is, of course, create a Francoist king. And I mean, going back to some of the things that Christopher showed, were Juan Carlos is unfairly criticised for not moving ahead in the first week or so and removing, you know, this institutionalised dictatorship with the army already committed to its perpetuation, the army, the civil guard, the Policía Armada, all the phalangists with arms licences, etc. At that point, his legitimacy is very shaky. His only legitimacy is that he's Franco's chosen successor. He is a Francoist king. He builds legitimacy by the reform project of September 1976, by the constitution. He gets dynastic legitimacy in the spring of 1977, when his father abdicates. Mm-hmm. His father isn't king, but he abdicates anyway. And then he gets, if you like, popular legitimacy through his role as the bombero de la democracia and everything he does, particularly because of dismantling the Tegucigalpa. Just, I don't know if that answers your question. I had to get it off my chest.
What about Alfonso de Borbón? Did he have any chance to become a king?
No, I mean, you know, obviously he was one of the six candidates. There were two, if you like, legitimate Bourbons. There's Juan Carlos and his father. Mm-hmm. There's Don Juan's deaf and dumb brother, Jaime de Bourbon. Mm-hmm. There's Alfonso, who is his son. And then there are two Carlists, and he plays Don. And one of the things that Franco does in order to keep Don Juan under control is he actually finances Jaime, who is a, it is Jaime, isn't it? Javier, I can't remember now, the deaf and dumb one, who, of course, was older, but in the 1930s, when the monarchists were conspiring against the Republic, they had to do so by telephone, which put him at something of a disadvantage. So that's how Don Juan was. So Alfonso de Borbón, that Pierre, his legitimacy is pretty flimsy to begin with. He then consolidates it by copping off with Franco's granddaughter. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, then the Falange thinks, ooh, you know, we have a chance here of having a Falangist monarch. And that's when he starts to be called El Príncipe Azul. But no, I mean, the short answer is no. He was never a serious candidate.
Just to follow up there, Franco being the biggest Francoist, you also have to remember that Franco, of course, is Spain's first journalist, officially. In the Spanish Journalists Union, his carnet is 00001. So it's also part of his Franco's journalistic articles from Primer Periodista. Yeah. I think if you've seen the film Mientras Dure la Guerra, I don't know if you've seen it. Well, it'd be interesting to get people's opinion. I mean, it's an interesting film, but there's a great moment in it, and just listening to you now, where Unamuno talks to Franco because he's appealing for clemency for one of his professors at the University of Salamanca. Like, please don't kill him. And so he's received by Franco and Doña Carmen, and Unamuno says, you know, this guy, find out where he is. And Franco says to him,
Could you raise your voice?
Franco. That's good. Franco speaks so quietly. And Franco says to him, el problema es que lo tienen los nacionales. Que lo tienen los nacionales. Which is him. So there's a capacity to
distance himself.
Yes. That is the oldest joke. That's not true about someone else.
That's in the film.
Yes,
no,
maybe in the film.
Yeah, it's not true. I'm saying if they're using it as a as a hook line. It's extraordinary. Sorry, there was a question here.
No, I was just going to say that if Wikipedia is right, the last number of Arriva was published in June 1979.
Wow! Gosh, that's late 76, mate. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah, things keep going. And like I say, newspapers had to go to be approved right through until January 78.
Really?
Which is post Suarez elections.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, two and a half years after Franco's death. So yeah, these things go on, and the informes, you know, the reports on the editors of the newspapers are really, really interesting reading. All this is in Alcalá, for example, the analysis that they do of who is who in El País. It's like, don't worry about Carlos Mendo. I mean, he's a fan. He's that fijo, is what it actually writes, you know.
And that so is true.
But it goes on. You can see all the 12 first shareholders and the definition, because the structures are still in place. I mean, it's May 76, but it's only 6 months after his death. And so the way they just, like, receive these democratic offers to establish new newspapers, Avui, El País, etc., but they apply this, like, Francoist radiography to make sure that, you know, they're not too democratic or not going too far. And there's a person-by-person full report on each of them. It's just really... And this is in...
Can you
know,
remember what they said about 30
AM? But, yes. I've got the photo document.
Well, really, I think we better bring this to a close. You count yourself lucky because you've had two seminars in one about the monarchy and the other about the press. Thank you very much to Christopher, to Dr. Tulloch for coming along and for filling the two people's shoes. Thank you very much. Could you join me in thanks very much, sir.
Email. It's not quite so rainy there.